So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's December 30th, 2015. 2 days or so, or at this point, about just under 24 hours, or just more than 24 hours away from how many people in the West, the Western countries, mark the new year. And I wanted to use the occasion to explore something with you that I began with last week, when I talked about reassurance, feeling reassured as a very embodied, down-to-earth, feels kind of homey and homely, to feel reassured. Basis for relaxing craving, because when you feel reassured, there's less cause to resist what's unpleasant or grasp what's pleasant or cling to what's heartfelt, or want whatever's neutral to hurry up and get pleasurable, okay? Reassurance, to feel reassured. And so I called out last week 4 great reassurances. 1, the reassurance of safety. For example, the embodied sense that even when that alarm is going off, we're still okay, right? I've actually grown fond of that alarm. Because when it goes off, I get this jolt of excitement rippling through my nervous system, which kind of wakes me up. And also, I sort of can follow it. And also, it's such a great opportunity to relax into reassurance around safety in the face of an apparent threat. It's good practice because we're so vulnerable to threat as scared little monkeys. It's flashing, threat level orange, red alert, and actually, we're okay. So that's the first great reassurance, the reassurance of safety. The second great reassurance is the reassurance of contentment, that there is fullness, there is enoughness. We're okay. There's enough air to breathe. There's enough water to drink. When there is, when it's true. I'm not talking about false reassurances, but reassurances that are actual, like there's enough basis for going on being, the reassurance of satisfaction. And then third reassurance, the reassurance of connection, that even though others are not perfectly attuned, responsive partners, even the best therapists, and empathic parents, and all the rest of that, there's still an ongoingness of relatedness. And there's certainly the reassurance, fundamentally, no matter how unloving others can be and might be and are, we can also locate our own warm-heartedness and unilaterally find our own virtue and our own goodness toward others. That's a beautiful reassurance. Okay? And then the last reassurance was a little more troublesome. And I said it was a reassurance that all experiences are empty. And eyebrows rose, tongues wagged, Bill opined. It was wonderful. And I wanted to use that as kind of a springboard into this fundamental notion in Buddhism, as well as in articulated in all the great contemplative traditions of the world, but especially the Eastern ones. This balance, if you will, in an ultimate sense, of everything nothingness, fullness emptiness. And it's easy to get very abstract about this. And so I want to kind of try to bring it down as much as possible to our own experience of things. When, you know, I sort of returned to Buddhism about 20 years ago here in Marin County. I'd kind of been meditating since I was very young, wandered around in various practices, and really landed back in the Theravadan roots, the original roots of Buddhism about 20 years ago. My encounter with it was, it was like, you know, be more aware and be nicer, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, right? That's good. Be aware and be kind. Kindness and awareness, that's really good. But, or in addition to that, the deeper implications of awareness and the deeper implications of kindness take us into matters that are really profound. More profound than a mere psychology or morality of awareness and kindness. And this territory of fullness and emptiness, profound, even transcendent, overlaps with considerations of, is there a self? Is there a separate self? What is that apparent self? What is its nature? These considerations take us into questions about what is the actual nature of experience and the nature of material reality, the nature of mentality, the nature of materiality, right? Takes us out. Ultimately, it can take us into considerations of, is there some larger transcendental frame? The Buddha referred a lot to unconditionality as the framework in which mysteriously conditioned, caused phenomena arise and pass away. This territory that moves beyond what a guru had for a while called downtown religiosity. Conventional, you know, not bad, good stuff, better than the alternative. Awareness is better than the alternative, right? Kindness is better than the alternative. But this territory really kind of takes us out. And so I want to bring it down to earth and read two passages from Thich Nhat Hanh and explore a practical implication of the ways in which the fact that and the experience that experiences are empty of absolute nature because they're connected to everything else. It's not that there's nothingness, it's more that there's everythingness, which has lots and lots of implications. Okay. So maybe I should read the Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh, who, as you may know, I don't know if you know, he had a very, very serious stroke. And he's actually recovering amazingly. And if you're interested in his Sangha, and he's becoming for me a very important teacher and source. And one of the things that I can say has touched my heart really hugely is he was kind enough to actually endorse Hardwiring Happiness. So that was really meaningful personally. Like, whoa, Thich Nhat Hanh knows who I am? You know, I was like, whoa, thank you, Thich Nhat Hanh. Anyway, he's just an amazing being. I'll tell you a Thich Nhat Hanh story. It's a Rick and Thich Nhat Hanh story. So do you know who I'm talking about? Thich Nhat Hanh, the great peace advocate, Buddhist teacher, okay, Vietnamese origins. Anyway, he came to Spirit Rock about 20 years ago, before the buildings were there, mainly. And several thousand people came to hear him. And I sat up on the hillside with my sack lunch, because you're supposed to bring your lunch for the day. And I was listening to him talking, and I really didn't think anything of it. I kept waiting, like, where's the profundity here? You know, he just was sort of talking. It's hard to hear his voice. He's soft-spoken. The sound system wasn't that great. We're outside. And, you know, my mind was thinking, you know, where's the beef? Of course, he's a vegetarian, but anyway, you know, where's the stuff? Come on, bring it, zap me, I'm ready, right? Bring it on, like, ugh. And so, all right, so that all finishes, and then he walks up the path, up the hill, and I watch him walk by. It was very beautiful and moving, people follow him. All right, whatever. And then it's lunchtime, so I go sit under a tree, kind of off to the side, and I started opening up my lunch that I had some kind of sandwich in it and an orange. And I started peeling the orange and looking at the orange. It was so orangey and orange and smelled, and it was slow. And I realized it was very psychedelic. And I know what it's like to be psychedelic. I've had a lot of those kind of experiences. And I realized that he had inducted me into his mind stream. That the words were the least of it. He had just drawn me in somehow to this transmission of, and I'm not a woo-woo kind of guy. So if you're gonna draw me into your transmission, you've got some serious transmission, you know? Because I'm kind of resistant. I'm holding on to the rocks at the edge of the stream. So there's a powerful current carrying me along there. And that was really, really eye-opening for me to track the discrepancy between my rational, verbal, you know, evaluation of his words and what was really going on. Okay, so Thich Nhat Hanh. So I'll read you two passages here. His first passage is, and by the way, I had a contact lens cause me trouble earlier today. And so if I hold the text this close, that's why. So he says here, there's no phenomenon in the universe that does not intimately concern us. From a pebble resting at the bottom of the ocean to the movement of a galaxy millions of light years away, all phenomena are interdependent. Our Sangha, our gathering of practitioners, aspires to live in harmony with the land, with all the vegetation and animals, and with all our brothers and sisters, and transcending those gendered categories. When we are in harmony with each other, we are also in harmony with the land. We see our close relationship with every person and every species. The happiness and suffering of all humans and all other species is our own happiness and suffering, is our own happiness and suffering. We inter are. As practitioners, we see that we are part of and not separate from the soil, the forests, the rivers, and the sky. We share the same destiny. So there he's in particular, by the way, speaking to the interdependence of materiality, physical phenomena, animals and trees and so forth. And implicit in that, and very much what the Buddha spoke to, was the interdependence of mental phenomena. Thoughts, feelings, hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and remembering, hoping, wishing, planning, enjoying, suffering, and all the rest of that, experiences, our phenomenology, arise interdependently. And you can't mark absolute separations. You can't mark an absolute separation in your experience between hearing and seeing, thinking, feeling, remembering, right? They're different, but you can't cut a line through experience, right? Just as he's saying here, you can't cut a radical absolute line between phenomena, including particularly people. And it's interesting that as people have a deepening feeling for interbeing, as he puts it, they actually become happier and more joyful. There's something that happens as you kind of realize that you're, as I've put it, a local expression of allness, right? All these waves rippling through physical reality, culture, in the present, and in deep time historically, rippling through right now to make this moment of experience. This moment of experience contains all those causes within it as it ripples through us, as us, right? Like when you feel that and get that, really, it just makes you grin. Like, whoa, right? Even without psychedelics or Thich Nhat Hanh's, you know, mind stream, right? Okay, so, and then what happens is there's a releasing of craving. There's a non-grasping when you're everything. Why bother grasping to something? Why bother defending something, right, in an inappropriate, problematic sense, when you're out into everything and everything's rippling through you? A lot of implications there, right? So I want to do a little an experiential, embodied take on this, because it's so easy to trip out on it. It's okay for it to be kind of abstract, but really it's coming home to it. Okay, so a moment of breathing. Breathing is such an intimate and embodied way to enter R. So if you will, it's kind of a little practice, and feel very free to play with it for yourself. I suggest that you stop breathing for a little while. Just enough to start to really tune into your dependency on, you know, oxygen. So I'll be quiet for a few moments as we do this. And remember to breathe. Don't do anything alarming for yourself. But maybe pause breathing for a little bit. And you can also feel the ways that when you do breathe, that oxygen is energizing. Things happen in your body dependently upon inhalation. We also need to exhale. We need to rid ourselves of carbon dioxide. A key teacher of mine spoke of the rhythm or cycle of release, of receiving and releasing, releasing and receiving, in which we find our living, our being. And breathing is a very intimate and embodied way to get this. And of course, as you know, we are absorbing oxygen upon which we really depend. I nearly died trapped in kelp when I was 16. I drowned. I nearly died. And man, oh man, it's nothing like nearly drowning to help you appreciate your dependency upon oxygen, right? This beautiful, precious oxygen, of course, comes from green living things. We are inhaling their exhalations, and they inhale our carbon dioxide exhalations in a cycle of interdependency, of course. Right? And we can know that intellectually, but you can kind of almost feel it. Like, you know, this breath is receiving the gift of all these green things. Thank you, grass. Thank you, trees, you know? Thank you, weeds. Yeah, it's real, right? And of course, how do they produce the oxygen? You know, photosynthesis. They're propelled by sunlight. You know, they absorb literally the energy of our sun. It takes 8.5 minutes or so to travel here. Like, that's pretty amazing. And gets here, 8 minutes or so. When I was a kid, I thought, you know, wow, the sun could have blown up 4 minutes ago and we wouldn't know it yet. You know, literally. So, right? All these green things, you know, transform, in effect, sunlight into the exhalation of oxygen. And this oxygen, all these atoms of oxygen, were built inside exploding stars. Right? We're just kind of inhaling stardust, gifted to us by green things. How can you not be happy when you think about that? Right? Okay, it's very intimate. It's very real. Like, whoa, right under our noses all the time, every breath we take, you know? Stardust gifted to us by grass, in a, you know, via the sun. What? Okay. That's pretty, okay? Your body, good? I'm okay on time? Good. One more from the Zen master, all right? And peace advocate. So, this, and the title's kind of relevant, of his new book, Inside the Now, Meditations on Time. Okay, the now, time. He says, beloved one, you are not something that has been created. You did not come into the realm of being from the realm of non-being. You are a wonderful manifestation, like a pink cloud on the top of a mountain or a mysterious moonlit night. You are a flowing stream, the continuation of so many wonders. You are not a separate self. You are yourself. You are your yourself, but you are also me. You cannot take the pink cloud out of my fragrant tea this morning. And I cannot drink my tea without drinking my cloud. I am in you, and you are in me. if we take me out of you, then you would not be able to manifest as you are manifesting now. If we take you out of me, I would not be able to manifest as I am manifesting now. We cannot manifest without one another. We have to wait for each other in order to manifest together. So there he's especially speaking now to our social interbeing, our relational interbeing with others. Letting this sort of ripple and sink in. And reflecting on this myself and what to maybe speak to tonight, including at this time of year, seems like a very good time of year to reflect on interdependence. You know, with others, friends and family, activities, intentions, resolutions for the new year, as well as wider and wider, the whole wide world. A lot of attention these days to the interdependencies in this world, you know, for better or worse. Impacts, effects people have on each other. And I began reflecting on the needs of others in my own networks of being, and what happens when I don't take their needs into account fully, or I'm not really responsive to their needs, or I do things deliberately or inadvertently that impact them as threats to their needs. And as in effect, as Thich Nhat Hanh points to here, as I take into account their needs in skillful ways, without exhausting myself, it ripples back, taking care of my needs, and as I take care of my needs, I take care of their needs. So in terms of that circle, which has no beginning, I'm just going to focus on the part that's about responding to the needs of others. And I'm going to invite you to think about one or more, you know, currently, you know, kind of hot relationships. They're on your mind. Maybe they're awkward. Maybe it's an old relationship. The person's, you know, not in your life anymore, but it ended in conflict. Or maybe there's someone in your life that you feel troubled by or troubled with or troubled about. You know, it could be a very subtle little thing, or maybe it's a good relationship. But recently, there's kind of a burr under the saddle, as it were. There's a rock in your shoe, a little, right? So I invite you to think about that person, and it's okay to think about more than one. So in the first case, as you know, for me as a rough framework, it's useful to think about needs in three major piles: safety, satisfaction, and connection, broadly speaking, loosely related to our reptile, mammal, and primate human stages of evolution. Loosely. So in the first case, you might ask yourself, wow, in that relationship that's difficult, could I meet that person's needs better for safety? Could I give them more reassurance that I'm really not on attack? Can I lay down my weapons? You know, can I not keep pounding my point? Could I not come at them so fast or so hard? I realized that recently I sent out an email to my son, welcome to the 21st century, just summarizing some paperwork that he had left behind. And there was a way in which it came at him too fast and too hard. You know? My tone was really good. It was thoughtful. What I was saying was accurate and true. But as a package, ouch, came at him a little too fast, a little too hard. And it reminded him of too many moments when I really did come at him too fast and too hard when he was young, when he was a kid, as a dad. So little thoughts about that. So I'll be quiet for a moment as you might reflect on how to meet the safety needs of a key person in your life, authentically a little better. Or you might even discover that truly there's nothing you could do, really, to meet their safety needs. And in a sense, it's not about you, really, which is also a liberating freedom. Safety. You know, and you might imagine being more reassuring and how that might be good, how that might be rewarding, enjoyable, conflict avoiding, without walking on eggshells or denying your truth. I'm thinking about driving my wife, because I'm usually the driver. She gets alarmed easily in cars, even when nothing's happening. But anyway, and I'm just taken to, as she puts it, driving Miss Daisy. You know, I feel like I'm driving this rickety, you know, thing, but it's okay. It's like, I just take it on as a game. Why not be reassuring? It's not a big cost, right? Okay. Another is reassuring around the other person's satisfaction. Maybe they're looking for something to do with you that would be fun or enjoyable in relationships. Sometimes our partners have, you know, pleasure desires, sensual desires, that they're worried about whether they'll be satisfied. Food, affection, sex, shared entertainments, shared enthusiasms, people longing for a co-enthusiast, right? For entertainment of various kinds that's okay, or activities, or the ballet, or something, nature, whatever, you know? And they feel maybe kind of frustrated or disappointed, or as if their wishes don't matter, which is the most important issue. It's not so much that they're not getting what they want from you, but it seems like you don't care what they want from you, potentially. So there too, how could you have it be better if you address the needs of another person for satisfaction, for fun, for delight, enjoyment, pleasure? Eating their kind of food more often, going to their restaurant more often, watching their show more often, you know? Keeping it easy. You have needs for pleasure, for satisfaction, for accomplishing goals. Whether it's the goal of more tidiness and order in the home, it's my goal, or the goal of lightening up, my wife's goal. Either one's okay, you know, right? Meeting the goal of the other person, goal attainment. How could it go better if you help their need be met more? And then last, good on time, it's good. You know, need for connection, you know, for another person's need to feel like they matter, where you receive them. Dan Siegel has this great phrase, feeling felt, you know, the gift of feeling felt, helping them feel felt, received, even if we don't agree. And it helps to really know that you can receive others without waiving your own needs or rights or grievances. It, paradoxically, that helps us receive others better. You know, affection needs, prizing needs. You know, Ken Kesey had this line in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, feed the hungry bee. Sometimes when people pull for narcissistic supplies, they're actually pulling for a compliment or there's a bid for closeness. Often our natural response is dismissive or distancing, right? And I'm not talking about people have this annoying need to be flattered all the time. I'm talking about just, you know, social mammals, little monkeys, want praise or valuing or validating or, you know, a moving closer to their bid for closeness. Why not give it to them? Unless it wouldn't be wise. So I'll be quiet again here for a minute as you just reflect on meeting the needs of this key person or this part of the relationship, their needs for love, for feeling cared about, feeling like you're loyal to them. That's often a major imperative that people have, communicating, I'm loyal, I'm not disloyal, I'm with you. I may disagree, but I'm on your team. You know, or the need for them to feel like we're together, raising a family, or, you know, that we're, or their need that you're trustworthy to keep your agreements or to repair it when you break them. So I'll be quiet here too for a moment. Okay. And finishing up, being mindful of what that's like for us, for you, right? What's it like to kind of relax into kind of almost like a moving through yourself that's more meeting of the needs of others around you? What's that like? Can that feel okay? All right. What do you think about all this? Comments? Questions? New Year's resolutions? Yeah, please.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it possible that people can be brought closer together through conflict rather than splitting them apart and making them more angry?
So is it possible for people to come together through conflict rather than splitting apart? For sure, in my experience. I think I think sometimes people relate and they attach through conflict. And it's actually okay from the outside, you know, more sort of, I don't know what, California, mellowed out, chilled, you know, therapist types like me are like, oh my God. But for them, it's like, yo, baby, this is how we relate. This is how we have passion, you know? We're like East Coast, brother. And it's different style, or like Italian versus Swedish, you know, the stereotype, whatever. And it's okay, right? So I stress that, right? And I think that's really important to kind of call out that diversity, because the dominant paradigm, as it were, in a lot of, you know, mindfulness settings can be, let's just all be chill, nice, and get along, right? And there's a place for that too, but that can feel kind of oppressive and, you know, dismissive of others who are maybe hotter in their nature. On the other hand, and the Buddha put it well, you know, he said anger has a honeyed tip, but poison barb. You know, getting angry at others is another simile was that it's like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people get burned. Anger is the most salient interpersonal emotion. People react to it. They're affected by it. They remember it. It stays with them. It physically is active. And I think, you know, just being really aware of that and not casual about expressed anger. Doesn't mean suppressing the anger internally, but being very mindful of the expression of anger. And one vow I took some years ago that really has served me very, very well which I've broken, I'm sure, hundreds of times, was never to speak or act from anger. It's there inside, but to not speak or act from it, you know. Name it, perhaps, let it be present there, but it's artful here, what I'm trying to say. But what happened was that I got a lot more honest and real about what was under the anger, the hurt, the sadness, the fear, the shame, the inadequacy maybe, the pulling for reassurance that I wasn't getting, perhaps. And I became much more aware of the impact of my anger, including subtle, you know, husband-like or dad-like or teacher-like anger, you know, like exasperation. You know, that little, or, you know, that little look, you know, like, zap, pow. So thoughtfulness about that. And then last thing just about conflict is, is there a trajectory? Like, okay, maybe you rev up. There's like, you know, a normal fight, it's messy, but at some point, one or both people starts trying to find a softer landing. That's the key question. Is there a resolution, or does it just get stuck there? And it may be that the other person needs to fight with you. Like our daughter recently, you know, told me in effect that she really wanted me to just let it rip back more. That it was weird for her that I'd go all jiu-jitsu, Dalai Lama jiu-jitsu on her. You know, it's like, whoosh. It's like, she wanted a meeting. And maybe that's a need someone has.
How old?
25. A lot of history there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, okay, I'll spare you my family drama. But anyway, other comments? What do you, you know, inner being, interdependent being. Yeah, not too cosmic, down to earth. Yeah, please.
So here's my comment. When I was raised, even my mother, when she, of course she had a psychology degree and several.
Uh-oh.
Generous, couldn't ask for more. But the past couple of years, I've always extended myself just to have the courtesy of seeing gratitude that, you know, so in a soul way, I don't think of material way, that people are in your life. I don't think like the teacher you said you spoke about, it's not a matter of taking psychedelic, I don't even know, I never took any psychedelic drugs or anything, but I think people at that level, at the Buddhism level and the higher soul level, Akashic level, or okay, you know, I'm not Nostradamus, I don't read records, but that level are there, they're beings, they're love. You don't need anything, you're just there and you feel them. You don't expect.
Sure.
And I love that part where you said, one, you are I am you.
Yeah.
But there are some people, I could agree with this gentleman, that you want to clear that karmic path up.
Sure.
And, you know, say, hey, I'm gratitude for all you've done, but, you know, let's be. You know, you know when that person's there, he still hates you. And it's like, how much you try, you know, you can't keep banging your head against the wall. So you have to kind of resolve it,
yeah,
in a way of, not everybody's going to like me, I guess. You try, but you keep trying, and, you know, you keep sending Christmas cards and talking to that person just dismisses you. I guess you can't clean up those paths, those types of paths sometimes, you know.
Right. I think, if that's great. I appreciate that. And
yeah,
in a way... say that again?
I'm not trying to get any, you know, I'm just saying there's some things you can't change.
Oh, yeah.
Some things you try, and I think that there are certain beings that are more connected to God. And
yeah, yeah.
The other ones that
even if you're not pulling for appreciation,
yeah,
I appreciate it. So it's cool. But I think we're talking in a way about, okay, what about conflicts, right? And also kind of going forward, you know, meeting needs of others. And responding to their needs going forward, right? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And doing that meeting of needs rested in to the extent it's real for you from time to time, in a larger wisdom awareness, you know, of inner being, that we're connected with each other. And it's based on that fundamental truth that we practice, let's say, if we do, responding to the needs of others and letting them land, you know, right? So what do you make of that? How do you feel about that in your own life? People you live with, people you work with, meeting their needs. You know? Does it feel like it will be exhausting? You're sick of meeting people's needs, you know? You're a woman and you're tired of like being cast into a role in which your job is to meet the needs of others who don't meet yours. I mean, whatever. I mean, what do you make of all this? Yeah, Lily.
I have a question about that. Sometimes, where do you draw the line? Because I'm just thinking of relationships where are good and some that are conflict.
Yeah.
But either way, you know, trying to meet the needs of the other person is a wonderful thing. But how do you know sometimes when it's the right thing to do to meet their needs, particularly in a conflict, or to kind of stand your own ground to meet your own needs?
Yeah. I think that's a huge question for us all. And the first thing that strikes me, and it's in my own practice too, is to what extent do I actually let myself feel the need of the other person? Right off the top, particularly the deep need, you know, the need for respect that's under their annoying righteousness, let's say, or the need for autonomy that's underneath their pushing me away, maybe, or just their need, you know, for pleasure, for aliveness, rather than some kind of numbing, I don't know what to call it, you know, like business-like interaction. Whatever that might be, just right there. That's the first thing. Do we actually let the need, if you will, the want, but the deep, you know, like especially the deep need, we're basically all kind of local manifestations of species-wide needs. Think of it. They're grounded in our nature as human animals that ripple through us. We're just, you know, each one of us is kind of tuning up, dialing up, or dialing down some kind of Homo sapiens collection of needs rippling locally, moment to moment to moment. We are joined. We inter-be, we inter-need in a lot of ways, right? And can we receive interly the need of the other? Just at a real human level, like their need to make eye contact and to feel seen, like, or to feel like they've actually landed in our heart. That's really huge right there. Even if we don't meet their need, but we've received their need. I think our deep need is to feel that our needs have been received. Secondarily, are you going to meet my needs? Are you going to give me what I want? But deeply, have you received what I want? Right? Like right there, that's really, really big. For me, that's very foundational. And then we kind of work it out, right? I think a lot. We sort through, you know, what's wise about meeting your need. Also, I think it's really important to be super clear on your own rights. You don't need to meet their needs. If you can't say no, your yes doesn't mean anything, in a sense. It's forced, right? So I think, weirdly enough, autonomy, you know, is the fundamental thing. Because yes, we inter-be, but if you don't have some fundamental sense of your own capacity to freely respond to needs of others, you can't have intimacy, I think. Right? So then you work it out from there. But I think where it gets very real in practice is, you know, it's the feeling over here. You feel it. Like, have I let your needs land? Have I slowed it down? You know, have I shored up my sense of me-ness so that I can tolerate we-ness? Right? So I could really receive you and then take it from there. But I think that's the first step. And if That's usually the problem. We didn't really receive their need, where we felt overwhelmed by their need. We needed to actually back up a step to really be able to stay present with their need, you know. Or we just took it we just registered the surface need and got started twirling around about that, rather than really receiving and slowing it down to feel the deeper need at work there. Okay. Well, we've gone on. I've gone on. You have a need probably to leave on time, right? So if it's all right, I'd love to read that last passage from Thich Nhat Hanh, that last one, and then we'll just shh. Okay. Yep. Let's see. All right. And these come, by the way, from the newsletter Planting Seeds of Compassion. So I'm their mailing list. You know, that's where I get these. If you want to get this kind of stuff yourself. Okay. Okay, here we go. Beloved one, you are not something that has been created. You did not come into the realm of being from the realm of non-being. You are a wonderful manifestation, like a pink cloud on the top of a mountain, or a mysterious moonlit night. You are a flowing stream, the continuation of so many wonders. You are not a separate self. You are yourself, but you also are me. You cannot take the pink cloud out of my fragrant tea this morning. And I cannot drink my tea without drinking my cloud. I am in you and you are in me. If we take me out of you, then you would not be able to manifest as you are manifesting now. If we take you out of me, I would not be able to manifest as I am manifesting now. We cannot manifest without one another. We have to wait for each other in order to manifest together. Thank you. Inter-R-ing we go. See you next year.